Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager, and you are listening to The Heretics Hour on Monday, September 15th, 2014. My, I'm just happy that I'm here because I had quite a difficult time connecting tonight. Something is screwed up. It might be, they seem to think it's at my end, or is it the way that they're handling these call-ins? Blog Talk keeps saying they don't change anything, but it's something about Skype, maybe. But anyway, I did it a different way, and here I am talking to you, and right on time also. So I'm a little bit, I've been through a little bit of a fluster there. So tonight my topic is one that is, I guess another controversial subject, and maybe it might seem strange to people that I am saying, in praise of my ancestors. Well, it's not in a sense of bragging, but in a sense of wanting to give appreciation to the whole idea of all of our ancestors and what they mean to us, but especially I think to mine because of the way that they have been handling things. I've got a little message coming up here. Let's see what it's saying. She's telling me. She's giving me some instructions. Okay, for the next time. The Blog Talk lady. So let me put this down. It gets more and more difficult to do programs, it seems like. But I'll just continue on here with what I was saying. So I'm going to start out. I'm going to start out today with, I don't know if I've left out something from the way I usually announce the show, but I'm going to start out with a little complaint, not a complaint, but I guess you could say a little complaint about someone who sent a comment to my website, carolynyeager.com. And I wouldn't normally mention it, but this is someone whose name whose screen name I've seen around on other sites quite a bit, and he wrote something rather critical, and I would have okayed it, except that it was in the wrong place. He didn't put it to the on the post to the program that he was talking about. He put it somewhere else, obviously by mistake, but I can't change those things without turning it into my comment. So I looked for his email address to write him an email and explain that to him, that he had to move it. And I found, of course, that not surprisingly, that his email address, I wrote to him and it came bounced right back to me, saying that this address was not found. There was no such host or domain name. These people, they write with the name that he uses, and I'm going to use it, and I'm going to say what it is. He uses the name Truth Speech, all in lowercase letters. And he wrote to me that he's saying, just to go on, and then he uses an email address. It's just something he makes up. In this case, it was forward@directormail.com. I thought it seemed kind of, but I thought, well, maybe he uses an email company that forwards things, so his name is not on it, but it doesn't even exist. So in this case, I get tired of people. I get real tired of people who do this. I don't mind if they say something critical, but I do mind if they write in and won't use their real email address, let alone their real name. So they're totally and completely anonymous people. What the heck is the point of it? I realize that people might say, well, you know, that people are afraid that when they write to comment that the person who's getting their email address is going to report them to the to whatever, you know, to Mossad or something. Well, I'm not going to do that, but then I can't convince people that I'm not going to do that. So I guess that is supposed to be some reason why people are able to protect themselves so much. But here's what this person wrote. He wrote, there's two points to it. Number one is, so Carolyn mentions that French President Hollande, this would have been for my show last Monday, French President Hollande is a liberal, but no mention that he is a Jew. France has had two Jew presidents in a row now, Hollande and Sarkozy. No need to bother explaining about destructive liberal tendencies of these vile aliens when the shortcut is simply to say they are Jews. That tells the listener all they need to know. Well, so I looked up trying to find out anything on Hollande being a Jew. And, of course, Hollande was born a Catholic, and he renounced his faith at some age. He's an atheist and so on. I don't believe he's a Jew. I didn't find anything that indicated that he was a Jew. But this person wants to call him a Jew. It doesn't matter, really, being his politics, whether he's a Jew or not. And he doesn't know. He's just saying that. So his number two point is, Carolyn, did I really hear you say that Greece had a, quote, hard-on, unquote, to get into the EU? I'm disappointed to hear you use a vulgarity like that. I'm no prude, but as I became racially conscious, I've become more aware of the vulgarity of the Jew and the Negroid that has permeated our white society. I've worked to purge that kind of vulgarity from my own speech and thinking, and I've come to appreciate being among whites, including virtually, and the lesser amount of vulgarity that comes with that. Well, it's not written too well, but so, you know, just some way to bother me. And I'm probably making too much out of it, but I'm only mentioning it because I don't want this person to say that he wrote a comment on my about my program or whatever, and I didn't post it. Well, I was going to post it, but it was to the wrong program that he put it. And when I tried to write to him and tell him to write it again to the right program, I wasn't able to write to him. So there you go. That's the things that sometimes take up time with people and the problems that you have to deal with and why you get disgusted, very disgusted with the situation on the internet and the people who use it, untruthfully and not as to what they are. And I have found so often that people with names like this, these kind of screen names, often indicate the opposite of what they call themselves. Like this man is calling himself Truth Speech, you know, yeah. So there's just the opposite kind of speech that he uses. So I thought, since I couldn't reach him, I thought I'd mention that on the air today before I got going. Well, with this topic I have, it's a combination of things that brought me to it today, but mainly is because I've been working on my ancestry, and I've already talked about it some, and I have something on my website about it, but I need to expand it. It's called Carolyn's Ancestry, and it's on the right side column, right sidebar. But I need to add now what I've got, what I've learned to it. And I was, because my ancestry has always been, for most of my life, kind of a mystery as to details, I never thought I would ever learn as much as I know today, and to have finally tracked down where my family origins are in Germany it was real exciting to me. I feel real happy and satisfied about it. Naturally, I'm sharing it with others in my family, or I will be. But I did before shared what I had found out, and I didn't. There are a few people that were kind of interested, but I think a lot of them aren't. But they might be more interested in this part, being where they were in Germany. And with my family, it's I have an unusual family in that there's very little variation in it. Very little difference amongst where people came from. They all came from the same place, both in the community in Hungary that they were a part of, and also in the, it turns out, in the community in Germany that they originally came from. And that's really not very surprising to me, because I knew that they were from a certain area, but I didn't know it'd be quite so close, so close together. So the themes that I'm going to I'm going to get into that, but I want to have a little I want to speak in a little bit in an introductory way first about some themes, and I put them in this way: 3 points. 1, exclusion; 2, race versus the spiritual or biological versus attitude or belief; and 3, differences. Good or not good? How good are our differences? And I I accept the National Socialist teachings and what Adolf Hitler himself said, that nature is the model. I found that to be intelligent and sensible when I first read about it, and it struck a chord in me, and it's been just increasing in for me, in the sense of, in the way of being the best way to look at it that I could ever think of. That so there are many. So as putting nature as the model, there are many and various species, but each keeps to its own kind. That's the lesson there. And so dealing with the first item, exclusion. The movement in the modern world, in our modern world today, that we complain about so much, is to deny people the right of exclusion. This originates mainly from the Jews. It does. You have to say it, because it does. And they are the greatest force behind it, because it benefits them. It benefits to not allow people, to exclude other people, because they know they're going to be the ones who will be excluded, and so they push the idea of it's wrong to exclude anyone. The Soviet Union was an example of this, as representing the proletariat. The leadership of the Soviet Union was similar to what the Jews are doing in general, that saying that they represent the proletariat, but in actuality, they become the new ruling class. And I'll just mention here, my good buddy here, Vladimir Putin, follows along in the same footsteps, that he doesn't believe in exclusion. He doesn't want any exclusionary policies in the Russian Federation, but he is certainly putting himself in the position of the ruler, and people seem to like that, and so there's not much argument to him doing that. But there's no exclusion in Russia, as I said, and there's no anti-Semitism allowed. This is his policy. The key is to see who is forbidding our right to exclude others from our group, and I've already said it's the people who think that exclusion wouldn't work for them. To form into groups of like-minded people and physically alike people is our right, and it's natural. To make it appear wrong and hurtful, harmful, is unnatural, but That's the ruling policy in the world today, that it's wrong and it hurts people and harms the people who are not allowed to be in a group, who are because of physical reasons, sometimes. And as a matter of fact, the New World Order is equals a global ruling class rather than national rulers. So there's always going to be rulers. I mean, I guess I was thinking today that putting it this way, that no matter what we might think of not wanting people to rule over us, there has to be rulers and there always will be rulers. And that most people are not going to don't want to take that kind of responsibility and don't want to even think much about it. So somebody's going to do so, and most people need someone to lead them and to guide along the way. And so there's always going to be rulers. And those who say that they don't want rulers, I guess that's anarchists. Well, I've never been could warm up to anarchy at all, and I don't see any value in it, truthfully. You end up being ruled over by something worse than somebody who you would actually know who they are and acknowledge them, or they are acknowledged as a ruler. So the new world order, though, naturally has rulers, and it's the global ruling class rather than national rulers. It's a multinational class rule is what it is. Based on a class, on an elite class that they determine is part of those that they bring into their elite group, and it's not to be based on racialism or ethnic. It's not racial or ethnic. And that's why nationhood is abominable to them. I mean, just anything that smells of nationalism is truly hated and must be wiped out by this new world order, or what you could call the global, made up of a global ruling class. And that's the situation we're in today. And how we got there is not what I'm going to be talking about today, but I'll leave that number one there and go on to a few comments here about number two, race versus the idea of the spiritual. The idea that we should overlook race and ethnicity if someone has the right spiritual qualities is what we hear from a lot of people today. And it's usually held by mixed race people and less than all white people. We do things out of our own self interest. This is just natural, and I think we can't really help it because we see things from our own point of view, and really you could say our own biology and our own blood. And if we are something, we want that something to be either just accepted or even held up maybe as the ideal or the model. So if your race or ethnicity is in question, well, then you don't want that to be the rule that's gone by if you want to be a part of a movement or of a cause or of people who are of a certain race or ethnicity. So this is another thing that we run into today, and I have my definite views on it, which you can tell, I'm sure, from this program what they are. They're the biology and blood over what's called spiritual quality. And then three, differences. The differences are differences good or bad, or the actual fact is that differences create conflict. sure, there may be healthy conflict, which creates a new type of synthesis or some new ideas. Sometimes you can't avoid ever having conflict, and you wouldn't want to, because then everything would just be, would kind of die from nothing happening, I suppose, because conflict is a part of life, but too much conflict is in conflict of the wrong kind. So is the new better than what was? That's the thing. Is this new thing that's created out of conflict better than what was? Maybe not. But conflict can also weaken and break apart. So I see it that if differences are not recognized for exactly what they are, but are believed to be of no importance, and therefore allowed to percolate and cause misunderstanding, confusion, and loss of clear direction, then that can be disastrous. So in this case, sameness would be preferable over differences, even if it's less interesting. When things are the same, there's agreement, and there's no surprises, and you know what to expect. And when there's a lot of differences, you don't know what to expect, and you're not sure what's going to happen, and things can be causing misunderstanding and confusion, and that can end up with it recognized, or people are not willing to look at it or call it out or speak about it, then that can be disastrous. So with that as a beginning point, I'll say that I spent quite a lot of time. Now, I'll also say that this program might be really boring. I think it's going to be interesting in a lot of things that I'm going to say, maybe not all parts of it to all of you, but it might seem, as I already said in the beginning, a strange thing to do a show on. But I spent quite a lot of time now investigating the four branches of my family. That's my four grandparent branches. And as I've said before in talking about this, I have it easier than most because I have this Santana family book, which has all of these members of this community organized and numbered and according to all the birth and death and marriage and so on records. And other things, there's other sources. I found out that there are a lot of family books out there from people who have lived in outlying communities say, in this case, German communities, Germans. And there's other locations where they are, and family books have been created for those places, too. And the man, Alf Kurt, who did the one for Santana, whose wife is from this, and now he's just discovered that he has some connection to it, to Santana, too. But he's looked at all of those, plus checked a lot of things on the Internet, then he gets information from the people who are in the book, like myself. I've even sent him things that aren't in there or that aren't fully, that didn't have all the details on certain people that I learned, and then I sent it to him, and he's added it. So that's how these things get built up, and he's been doing this for quite a long time. So he's had I don't know how many versions of this book, So it's pretty complete, and yet there's some information that cannot obviously be found if nobody wrote it down anywhere. And I'm sorry that finding the exact location of where my the first family member came to Santana, where they came from, finding that exact information is difficult for most of them. But I've gone through a lot of this material, and I've come to some pretty certain conclusions. So I'm gonna go through that now first, and then I'll talk about a few other things afterwards. So I'll say that this is what I've been concentrating on recently, is discovering, if I could, the locations in Germany where my family originated. And I did find it there. And so I have it now, and I'm pretty excited that what I was thinking was probably right is right, but it's not. It's more narrowed down than I had thought. So one feature that I just discovered in the book on Friday, this last Friday, is the names of the German towns and villages that are known that the settlers came from. So he's got a lot of things in the back of the second volume that I hadn't even gone to. And once I discovered that, I got some new information. So there are 51 German towns and villages that he has listed that are mentioned as these people from Santana in Hungary coming from. You know, I'm going to some of you might not realize. Maybe I need to go through just real quickly what I'm talking about here. This starting my program, and then I kind of woke up from a nap late, and I was a little bit flustered in getting started here. But maybe I better go to this and remind you and tell those of you who might be scratching your head at this point that in around 1750, a group of people from the Baden area, it's called Baden-Württemberg, but that's what it is today, but it was at that time Baden, and not so many from Württemberg, really mostly Baden, in southwest Germany, were encouraged to travel to Hungary, because there were boats and barges that went along the Danube River, taking them there, and then they traveled on by land to get to this area, and it was a town called Komlos, a Hungarian village, and it was all that land there was owned by a Hungarian baron named Jacob Bibix. This was after the victory over the Ottomans by the Austria-Hungarian Empire, and some others I think might have joined in on that. But then they wanted this land to be settled. And you know, when it's not only here, but in other places, when they wanted farmers to come and work the land and settle there, and make it civilized and also populated so that the Turks wouldn't take it over again, they would turn to the Germans. And since this was Austria-Hungary was an empire at this time, Empress Maria Theresia asked Austrians and Southern Germans to go, and there was going around or making announcements or something in this particularly noted farming area called the Kreisgau. It's pronounced Kreisgau in Baden, and I've got some information on that I'll get to in a minute. But they encouraged whoever would go and promised them nice things. But in the end, it wasn't so great when they got there, but they were there, and they made it work. And so this Baron Bibix, he owned all this land. And next to the Hungarian village, which had been called Komlos, it ended up being called Old Santana, because the new settlement of Germans was set up next to it. So this was just a German-only new town that was, and he had built a, he already had built a bunch of houses, about several dozen houses in a square with a market, big open marketplace in the middle, and then he built a church and a school and got the Piarist order to come and teach in the school. There was a convent there for them and to teach the children, and there's a, you know, someone for the church, I guess. And because these, and the people that came from Baden were all Catholic. And so what I'm going to, that's where I was when I said that, that it, according to the records that, that are available, there were the names of 51 German towns and villages that these settlers came from. And all but seven are in Baden-Württemberg. So that's pretty, that tells you right there that the odds are very high that of the people who went there, that's where they came from. And the thing is, it's actually Baden and not hardly Württemberg. So I'm going to tell you the history of Baden-Württemberg as far as their being connected together goes. And it's this, that after Baden-Württemberg officially became a state, officially merged only in 1952. Up until then, it was Baden and there was Württemberg, separate states. And it, actually, there was three. After World War II, the Allied forces established three federal states, Württemberg, Hohenzollern, that's one, and Baden, and both of those were occupied by France after the war. They were, you know, turned over to France. And Württemberg-Baden, a different section, which was U.S. occupied. In 1949, these three states became founding members of the Federal Republic of Germany. Article 118 of the new German Constitution, however, had already been prepared, had already prepared a procedure for those states to merge. Ha. And after a referendum, I say ha ha, because you know, they did a referendum, but they knew that the people would vote for it because they didn't have much choice, I suppose. And they had already prepared this procedure ahead of time, and they the referendum was held on December 16th, 1951. And at that time, they voted for the merger, and that's when it became a single state, Baden-Württemberg, in 1952. And the Baden is on the western side of it, and it's the Rhine River forms the western border, as well as a large portion of the southern border. The Black Forest, the Schwarzwald, but commonly known as the Black Forest, is main mountain range of the state. It rises east of the Rhine Valley, directly to the north, also along the Rhine, is the Kraichgau. So the Kraichgau area is directly north of the Black Forest in this section of southwest Germany, that is right along the border there. And, you know, I used to think that this was all Swabian, but now I'm not so sure. Like many cultural regions of Europe, Swabian borders are not clearly defined. However, today it's normally thought of as comprising the former German state of Württemberg, along with the Prussian Hohenzollern province, and the administrative region of Bavarian Swabia. So part of what's considered Swabian is in Bavaria. It takes up most of Württemberg, but just a little bit of Baden, the Baden section. And it sort of goes along the eastern edge of this Kraichgau area, but so it's hard to determine. And these things overlap, and people are, you know, get influenced by things, and so it's hard to determine what exactly what's Swabian and what isn't. It's not that important. But the other thing I did was to check more carefully the section at the beginning of every family name that lists those who were not born in Santana but died there, and so they came from somewhere else, or maybe they were not born in Santana and they never went there at all. But there's at the head of every section of family of every family name, there's a lot of these that don't have a number because they weren't born in Hungary, but they were often listed as the parents of people who were who did go there, not necessarily born there, but who went there, or who were born there if they went there later. So you get some names of towns and villages, but sometimes there's a name, but most of the time there isn't one. If they don't know, if nobody ever said or recorded what it was, so then they use letters like A, B, or C if they correspond to someone in the main part. And for every one of my my family names, there were some towns or villages listed there, but I don't know that they were my particular family member. Sometimes, in one case, I do know, but only in one case am I certain of that. And sometimes there's only two of them. Sometimes there's four or five village names listed. And I also could see the names of sometimes of the person that they married, and their village is given, maybe where they married or where they died or something. So I looked up those places, and then I found that they were all close together in, you know, in this one area. And I originally discovered that my maternal grandmother's family came from Bauerbach, Baden, Germany. I mean, that was listed there on the first two that are in the book of the earliest of the names there for the Reck family. And of my particular Reck family, might be the only Reck family as far as I know, but that was listed for them, and that is. Then I noticed that some Schillinger women from my Schillinger family line had in that upper section had in the 1700s had married men who were born in Eppingen and Dettingen, two of them in Eppingen, one in Dettingen, and I found that was in that area in Baden, between Heidelberg and Stuttgart. So then I'm reading about the settlement itself, and of course I said this before, but that Alf Kurt said that a large percentage, or maybe it was a majority of the settlers, came from the Kraichgau in Baden, and that's spelled Kraichgau. And so what is the Kraichgau? I found it's pronounced like that. It's Kraichgau, not Gau. It's spelled like a Gau, you know, the German Gaus, G-A-U, but I always pronounce it Gau, but I guess it's not pronounced Gau. It's pronounced Gau, Gau. So, and the Kraichgau is a, according to Wikipedia, is a hilly region in Baden-Württemberg, north, but they always have it now because that's the state now, is Baden-Württemberg, but you could just say Baden, as far as I'm concerned. And I, not that I have anything against Württemberg. I don't. It's new, you know, and it's a time that I'm thinking about. I mean, it was mainly in Baden. So it's bordered by the Odenwald and the Neckar River to the north and the Black Forest to the south. in the Upper Rhine Plain to the west, to the east, its boundary is considered to be the Stromberg, that's in the south, the Hart, eastern part of the Black Forest, and the Tückelberg, directly between Heilbronn and Eppingen. Now, Heilbronn is, there's four cities that kind of make up the corners of this area. Heidelberg on the northwest, but it doesn't really reach that far to Heidelberg. Heidelberg's not a part of it. Heidelberg's a little above it, but that's right below that it starts. And then over to the, let me get my map. Now, you know that map, I would like to say also, that map that I put on my program page, that's very helpful. It's amazing. Most everything I'm going to talk about took place in this outlined area, which is the Kreischgau. And you can enlarge the map and if you're interested and look at it, and you can see Heidelberg up there, you know, above the boundary, and then over the other corner to the, what you'd call the northeast would be Heilbronn, and that's a major city. And then you have going down, you have it gets narrower in the south, and you have Forsheim, which is a well-known, pretty large city. And then on the other corner, Karlsruhe. So there you have it. And the main towns that I'm going to be speaking about is Bretten and Kreischtal and Eppingen. And this is a very small area, really. You know, it took me a while to get used to what this is, because I think, well, this looks pretty big here. Not just this map, but other places, I think, well, that's, but look at the, it's just like tiny, 20 kilometers across in the narrow part down south. That's a very small area. This was a farming area. Did I already say that? It's a place with a loam. I haven't read that part yet, what the Kreischgau is. Here it is. The largest towns are, if you're looking at it, the largest towns are Sinsheim, Eppingen, and Bretten, and they're not that large. On the western end of the Kreischgau is the town of Rüxall. That's over in the greener part, the name is printed. And that is the gateway to the Rhineland plains. And you can see the Rhine River over in the corner there. So, and Speyer, a very famous, very, very old and noted small town that is one of the oldest in Germany. And I visited there. Gunther Deckert took me there. Gunther Deckert's from just north of here, in the Palatinate, as he calls it, in Weinheim he lives, which is around Mannheim, and it's all south of Frankfurt. And we went to Heidelberg, and we went to Speyer, and we went to Mannheim and some places up further north. And I didn't know at the time that I was right there by my ancestral homeland, if you want to call it that, which is actually what it is, my ancestral homeland. There it is. I could go there now. I could go visit, you know, go check around and see things and so on if I wanted to go to Germany again, or I'd like to go to Germany again, but it's just the travel, the effort of the trouble of traveling, you know, that traveling is not simple, is not easy. So, but I might do it. So, but let me continue on here about the Kreischgau. The Kreischgau is I said the word kreish is apparently arose from the Celtic word kreuch, C-R-E-U-C-H, meaning mud or loam. It's the territory of a goal that signifies an open area free from woods such as farmland or meadows. So this is an area with basically farmland and meadowland. It's not a big forest in here, anything that would get in the way of having a lot of, farms. So it was first mentioned in the early Middle Ages in the Lorsch Codex as Kreishgau in the year 769. In 773, it was called Kreigaui. And in 778, Kreishgauia. And in 1594, the name was closer to its modern form, being referred to as Kreuch. I don't know how it's K-R-E-U-C-H-G-A-U. But now it's K-R-A-I-C-H-G-A-U. So very distinctive region, although not very big, but Germany is so small compared to when you're an American, you live in the United States, and then when you're a Texan, you live in Texas, distances are so great, and, you think, when I think about how small this area is, but it's amazing what the Germans can do in the area that they have. It's all beautiful, and you see, it doesn't ever look crowded. It's just organized so well, is what I would say. And you can see there's lots of empty space around here in this, but there's a lot of little tiny, human settlements, little tiny groups of places and people here and there, always all through here. So to go on, I will begin then with Bauerbach, which is a village in the Breton district, I discovered, and it belonged to the bishopric of Spire in the 16th century, and it's one of the, as I already said, but Spire was one of the oldest cities in Germany. Well, Breton, you can see it there if you're looking. It's on the Saalbach River, and that is, it lies in the center of a rectangle is formed by, as I already said, this one says Heidelberg, Karlsruhe, Heilbrunn, and Stuttgart. It doesn't go all the way to Stuttgart. It goes, you can see, not on this map anyway, but somebody wrote it that way. It has a population of approximately 28,000. The center of Breton consists of many old half-timbered houses around a lively marketplace. Towns and villages under the administration of Breton include Bauerbach, Buchig, Diedelsheim, Dürrenbuchig, Goldshausen, Niebsheim, Rinklingen, and Ruit and Sprantal. Well, Bauerbach is where in 1718, Johann Georg Reck was born, R-E-C-K. And he grew up, he had a farm or on a farm, inherited a farm from his father or whatever, and married Barbara Stern right there in Bauerbach in 1741. And their fourth son, Andreas Reck, was born in 1764 in Bauerbach. And Andreas, I'm just speculating, but being the fourth son, he maybe thought he didn't have such good prospects because, the farm was always inherited by the oldest son. And it said on there that their first son was also a farmer, but it didn't say that about Andreas. And he probably decided that he would go to this place in Hungary where others were going and see how he could do there. So he did. And when he got there, after he got there, he married Maria Caterina Silberite in 1791 in Santana, Hungary, in that German new German village there, German settlement there. And one of their, just for future, for what moving on down the line, one of their sons, this couple was Franz, and Franz, with his wife, Theresia Schauer, S-C-H-U-A-U-E-R, gave birth to August, who married Barbara Hell. And August and Barbara Hell Reck were my great-grandparents. And their daughter, Barbara Reck, was my grandmother. She married Anton Schillinger in Chicago, they both having emigrated by then. He a little earlier, but from Santana. And their daughter, born in Chicago, was also named Barbara, who was my mother. I start to get confused when I start going down the line of these names. So there's a lot of Barbaras there. My grandmother's name was named Barbara. Her mother was Barbara. She married, she named her daughter Barbara. So that's how I know that that branch of my family does come from Breton in the center of the Christ Grove in Baden. I mean, that is for sure, that one. And I'm really pleased for that. Now, the rest of them are not as clear cut. Moving on to the Schillingers, which is also my mother's side of the family, my mother's father, the best bet I have for them is that they came from around Eppingen or the Kreishtal area. This is what I found in the first section for the Schillingers, was there was a Maria Anna Schillinger who married Georg Andreas Willi, W-I-L-L-I-E, and they married in... They married in, I think, in Santana, but he was born in Eppingen, Germany. And she was 17 at the time. I don't know where she, they don't say where she was born. She might have, they might have married in I think for some reason, though, I think that they married in Hungary. And so that's the only thing I know is that she married a man from Eppingen. And there's another Maria Gertrude Schillinger, born in 1754, who married someone from the Hell family. There are a lot of Hells, which is, as I already explained, is one of my family names. He was also born in Eppingen. So two Schillinger ladies, girls, married men who were born in Eppingen. So I'd assume that. That they were people from around where they were from. That's the way they did it. They didn't marry people they didn't know anything about. And you know, that brings up, and I don't know if it comes, I don't know if I've got that in here to talk about, but that brings up the idea that we have in the modern world that we should go out and find somebody. Some strangers, really. You know, we should go out and meet people and find somebody from far away sometimes who we don't know, really anything about, but we fall in love with them. And there was a lot of that in when I was growing up in movies and novels and so on that were you, even in very worthwhile literature. That, you know, this excitement of glamour of meeting people and falling madly in love and then having a rather tragic life because nothing works out well, but, you know, it's supposed to make a good story. And that you were supposed to find this, tall, dark, handsome stranger or something and have a fit of love for this person, and you just have to be with them, and they have to be with you, and you have this fantastic love affair. But it never works out, or you're not told about what happens after that in your whole married life. And that just doesn't work out. You know, it doesn't make sense. And people didn't used to do things like that. Certainly not ordinary rural people with no great money or no, but just living, you know, as best they could and so on, in communities. You just wouldn't do a thing like that. You married people you knew, and you married within a small area that you moved around in, and people then were good partners. In all of these, in all of my family, my direct family lines here, nobody got divorced, and nobody didn't stay married and didn't have children and raised children to the end. They sometimes one died. Usually it was the woman, but sometimes the husband died fairly young, and then the woman remarried, and the man also remarried. People seemed to remarry by the next year. They had remarried somebody new, because I think you had to be married. You wasn't comfortable to live as a single person. How are you going to live as a single person in the way of life that these people had? You just didn't do it. A man needed a wife. I think I've talked about this before. And women needed to have a home to live in. They didn't want to go back to their parents' home. And nobody did things like that. You found someone else, and you took the best one that was available, is what I think. Of course, you wanted to have respect, but these people all seemed to treat each other pretty well. And that's what happens when you know people, when you know the people. It's almost like a great big family, and you can't be a cad or a rotter, and so you can trust people. I think there's a lot of trust when you're the same kind of people from the same area, and everybody knows you. I think there's a lot of trust that goes on then, and people make do. They don't expect great love affairs, you know. But I think that for these people, they had courting, and they went through all the things that you would expect, and they really were attracted to one another. But after marriage, and you settle down, and you have all your hard work to do in life, and you start having your children, you know, you can't depend on that kind of thing. You have to have something else to depend on, and it has to be just that you're comfortable with one another, and you understand one another, and you feel like like you do about your own family. You're accepting of them, and you care about them. They care about you, but it may not be a lot of demonstration of affection going on all the time. Well, I'm just saying what I, you know, the way I would think it is, and the way I think real life is, and we should be prepared for real life. And when I was growing up, I got caught up like everybody in my in those times, girls and boys and so on, in a lot of this Hollywood mythology, and it expected things to be a certain way, and then we had the cultural Marxism and so on, and so everything was, if you're not happy, it's somebody's fault, you know, and you should do something about it, go look for somebody else, whatever. So this was totally new. I was the first person in my family to get a divorce, the first person. And then there was more after that, but my family members still have a good record of the younger ones, younger than me. Anyway, I want to go on here. I'm getting caught up in babbling. It's already an hour gone by. Another clue that I have here for the Schillingers is my great-great-grandfather, Franz Schillinger, married Anna Damminger in 1835 in Santana. And the Schillingers were probably, I figure, from the district of, I think I may have changed my mind on this, but the district of Heilbronn. The Damminger family shows all kinds of connections to Landhausen in the Kreisthal. That is where you see the name Kreisthal on the map. And the way these things work is that these place names are like districts. Germany seems to be made up of districts and districts within districts. So you have a larger district and then districts within that district. And then in those districts, you have some more breakdown. You might have some more breakdown of districts. So like Breton was a district and it had all those little villages, made up part of that district. And the same with Kreisthal and the same with Eppingen, but the Kreisthal was not as large. But the place named Landhausen was part of the Kreisthal district. And these Damingers are connected with the Schillingers in that Franz Damminger, who was born in 1870, married Barbara Schillinger in 1901, and she was, but she never went to the U.S., but she was my grandpa Schillinger's older sister. And then they had a son who was also named Franz, so we called him Frank. I knew him as Uncle Frank. He was my grandfather's nephew, therefore. So there was a relation there via marriage. Although when they went to in the U.S., their name was spelled Tamminger, T with a T rather than a D, T-A-M-I-N-G-E-R. But I just remembered them yesterday, I think. I said, well, where's the Tamingers? They must be in here. And they weren't. And then I thought, oh, the Damingers. And the Damingers were listed that said also spelled Tamminger. So Damminger and Tamminger are different spellings of that name, and why it's all in the book. It's all spelled with a D, but they may have spelled it with a T earlier than coming to the U.S. But I don't know. But anyway, that's how I know them. So I was happy to find them in there because I know quite a lot about them, and I could follow through and see if I could find out where they were from, and. It did show a lot of them coming from Landhausen in the Kreisthal. And, you know, whenever I find that there's someone from a further away place, I've come to realize that probably the one that's closer to within the Kreisthal would be the one that would be the ones that my family knew and was part of my this particular community that I'm part of. So that's where I connect. The Kreisthal is close to Breton, and the Rex came from Breton, and the Schillingers may have come from just not too far away there in the Kreisthal. And that is all part of the Heilbronn district. A large part of that is it's considered to be. So but Landhausen is part of the Kreisthal district. So now another thing is that the Schillingers intermarried with the Bleiziffers. And the Bleiziffers are a very large family group there. I never heard of that name before, but they are in my family. They are amongst my families in the females line, and there are two, not the female line, but as for marrying Bly's Different Women. And they're two earliest settlers carrying the name Bly's Differ, one born in 1725 and the other in 1738. Both came from Lingenfeld. And turns out that Lingenfeld is in the district of Germersheim in Rhineland-Palatinate, Germany. Well, you can approximately 10 kilometers southwest of Speyer. Well, you can see it there on the map over to the in the green part underneath Speyer. Now that's only 10 kilometers between those two places, and look at the distance there. And so Germersheim is another possibility possibly the Schillingers, but I would say it's probably over here in Christall or Eppington. So now I go to the Jaegers, and boy, the Jaegers are really bad at saying, giving any information about themselves. It's just terrible. There's just names and birth dates and death dates and so on, and marriage partners, but there's no location. So, but some Jaegers were from Weingarten. And there's a Weingarten in Baden. There's a better known, larger Weingarten in Württemberg, way down south. But this Weingarten would probably be the one in Baden. And it's situated at the transition from the Kraichgau to the Rhine Valley. So it's below Bruchsal. You see where Bruchsal is, which is below, in the green part, below Germersheim. Bruchsal is that little red town there on the Saalbach River. It's close to Breton, where the Bauerbach is. And it's on the Bertha Benz Memorial Route, which is a touristy route. It's a route. It's a special route for people who are, you know, vacationing and are wanting to see the sights and so on. And it says the village developed from a farm belonging to the Wissenburg Monastery in northern Alsace. It's considered to be the village's founding year. 0985 is the founding year of the village. Anyway, Weingarten is, Bruchsal is not far from Eppingen, which is to the east on the way to Heilbronn, but it's close to Lingenfeld, which I said, in Germersheim, and it's close to Breton. So, that's a possibility. That I'm quite sure that they all came from around the same kind of area. There's a Bleiziffer in the Jaeger line also as a wife. So I have two connections with the Bleiziffers. And another possibility, well, I don't think it is, though, is Mausenbachhausen. That was mentioned for some with Jaegers. And now I'm getting a Skype message, probably somebody telling me that I'm not making any sense here. No, I don't know what it is. Oh, Fred. Fred is encouraging me. Fred Tobin is encouraging me I feel like I'm not quite awake or something here. All right. Anyway, I'll continue. Going to get more interesting, folks. The Mausenbachhausen is another town mentioned in connection with the Jaegers, but I don't know that they're my Jaegers. But a lot of these Jaegers could be sort of related, you know, in different ways. But it's in the district of Heilbronn in Baden-Württemberg, so I don't need to say that last part. And but that's all connected there. See all that in the middle, Heilbronn, Schweigern, Eppingen, Kreisthal, all the way to Germersheim, Bruxelles. They're not in Britain. They're all in the same area here. So now I'm going to go to the last family line, the Schmidt family. That's my father's mother. Right off the bat, the earliest Schmidt in that first section where of people who were not born in Santana but were born in Germany is Betra. But there's a lot of Schmidt too. So they're not all my Schmidt. So I don't know. This Betra is in Freudenstadt, Karlsruhe. See Karlsruhe down there below Breton in Bruxelles, holding the southwest corner of the area. And it's on the east edge of the Black Forest, known for fresh air, many hotels and guest houses, and its high-class cuisine. Well, speaking of the Black Forest, it's always said that what's his name? Ernst Zundel is from the Black Forest. And somebody said today that they thought he was from around Forsheim. Well, Forsheim is there on the other bottom corner, and that's right above the Black Forest. So you never know when they say he might be from. I always think when they say he's from the Black Forest, I think about his being deep inside the Black Forest. In some kind of a house in the deep, dark woods, living there with his mother. His father died in the war. So he grew up with his mother and maybe some siblings. But that's what I always picture in my mind, see. But he may be from somewhere, you know, not quite so far down into the Black Forest. I don't know. We'd have to ask him. But he is definitely from, and I've known this. He's definitely from my part of the world there, and I've always known that he. I knew where he's from, so I knew my family was from, had to be from around there somewhere, and I thought, well, we're the same. We're from the same part of Germany. I always believed that. And you recognize your people who are from the same area that you're from. You really do. There's something in the blood. If the blood recognizes it, truthfully. And I want to say here that I'll bring this up, that geography is very, very important in feeling like you know people. When you're away from home and you meet somebody from around where your home is, and it's like you've met some long lost relative. You're both, oh yeah, I'm from there. Oh wow, and then you start talking about it, and you're ready to hug and kiss, and you know, you just feel like this is a member of your family almost, just because they come from the same. When I was in from the same state or the same area in your state, or let alone from your own hometown. But when I was in Germany, it was the first day. And Gunther Deckert had gone from the airport in Frankfurt, taken the train down to his home in his town, Weinheim, and he met me there. Boy, that was a scary trip, because my plane was late, very late, and I thought, God, I'm not going to make this meeting that we had set up, you know. In time, and he'll be there to meet me, and then he'll leave, and then I'll get there, and I won't know where he is. I managed to make it, and I was very nervous the whole time. I had to, you know, get the train ticket, I had to run around the airport, I had to do all these things, but I was a little, and then jet lag and all, so, and then he drove me around all day. We had a great time together, so we were like, people who had always known each other. I'd never met him before. Just contacted him through John. It was actually John Nugent who was nice enough to put me together with Gunter, and he was, it was so easy between us. And then he took me to the train station at the late in the afternoon to get my train where I was going to Weimar. So I was exhausted, you know, and I slept in the train. But anyway, when I went into the train station, and I did that by myself, you know, and I went to I had my my tickets all set up already, but I had to find the right place to get the right landing area, you know, what do you call it, platform. And so I'm always busy asking people things, but I got on this platform, and I was assured that this is where my train was going to come. But I don't know which direction it's going to come in. See, I'm always worrying, so I'm worrying a little bit. And I think I went and asked the conductor, I finally saw some kind of man there on the platform in a uniform. I went and asked him, and he assured me, yeah, it'd be long. So then I felt a little better. And then there was this woman there. I don't know who spoke first, but one of us did. And we chatted a bit and found out that she was from Texas. And I said, I'm from Texas. And she wasn't too far from where I was, not where I live. And then it was like, wow, it's like an old friend. You know, because you're in a strange place. And the fact that there's somebody from home, you just feel like, then we started talking a mile a minute. You know, we were like old buddies. It was a great feeling. It cheered me up. It's not that I don't like traveling and don't like to go to new places. I do. I've always have done that. But I'm not sure I'm going to make my train or I'm going to miss it, I worry about things like that because I create a very tight schedule for myself, and I don't want to miss out on anything. Anyway, that's just an example of people who are not even related at all, but we were just had to say we're just from the same geography. So when you come from the same geography, you have so much in common. I mean, Texas is not my real home, but my hometown is where I have a lot of understanding about people who live there. And it wouldn't be hard to get along with them at all because you have so much background in being in the same place and in the same type of people, because geography, I suppose you'd say, creates the people just more than the people create the geography. That's true too. Has a big influence on it. So back to the Schmidt family, another area that a lot of Schmidts came from was Kulsheim, but that's in the main Tauber district, northeast Baden-Württemberg. And at first, looking at the different maps and stuff, I thought that was a good choice, but I've changed my mind about that because it's not actually in the Kreisgau. And since most of the people who went to Santana are from the Kreisgau, then that makes it unlikely. So I crossed that out, there was a couple places that were mentioned, Rengershausen, that's also up there along the Tauber River, so that's not it. So then I have the choice of the Horchheim, seems to be one of the best choices, and Horchheim contains the village of Altdorf, and some people were from Altdorf. Just as at the eastern edge of the Kreisgau between Heilbronn and Forsheim. But I'm not convinced of any of these, so I have to say that I'm not sure about the Schmidt family, about my grandmother, but she might have been from somewhere a little bit further away, I mean, like some of these places, maybe not right there with the rest of them. Because she always did seem a little different from everybody else, a little bit not quite fitting in as easily to her generation there. But so who knows? But that's all I found out. But I can think that I can say for certain that that yes. Here's the other thing. Yeah, I can say that yes, my ancestors came from this area in Baden, this Kreischko area. For whatever it's worth, it's not the greatest, it's not the most impressive place in the world, but you know what? It sure is German, and it's full of half-timbered housing, and this whole Baden-Württemberg and Bavaria are kind of typical, more typical of what people, you know, all around the world think of as German than almost anything else. I mean, every place in Germany is German-like, but down here, down in this area, it's kind of the, maybe you could say the cliche idea of what Germany is, you know, or the most maybe stereotypical idea of what Germany is. So this is about as German as you can get, German-like as you can get. And I'm just thrilled, really, just to have a place to say, yeah, this is my home ground, and this is where my blood comes from. Because the other thing I want to emphasize today is that these people, my ancestors, and why I'm saying in praise of my ancestors, is because of what they accomplished, just naturally, and this comes up in the, I'm running out of time already. I didn't think I would be talking so much. This comes up in the, something I'm going to read from, if I can, something I'm going to read from Dr. Frerk's conclusion to his booklet on race that I've been posting. That was from Hattie Scott's blog, that keeping the blood the same, keeping the blood, I don't want to use the word pure, but not mixing the blood. And these ancestors of mine, certainly in all the time that I have recorded that they were in Hungary, and even after they, and when they went to the U.S., and my family continued to be this way without thinking about it, just naturally not marrying people from this, you know, from the same community, but still marrying German or Germanic people. And but going back to the Kreischko time before 1750, all the years that I'm sure they lived there, because they weren't people who would have been, you know, traveling around and finding, going here, going there. I think they're pretty much people who would have stayed where they were. I'm not saying they're here in the prehistorical times. I don't know how long they were here, but I would just have to assume that they've been here for a long time and continuing to marry within a certain range of German people and keeping their type, keeping that type alive. There's definitely a type. I mean, there is a type, this type of person I can see in myself in the traits that I have heard and heard about and so on. They just live in you. It's there. And there's different ideas about this, of course, you know. There's the idea of being a more adventurous soul. Well, I would say that my ancestors did go on an adventure out to Hungary, and then from Hungary they went on another adventure to the United States. So they weren't people who were afraid to go somewhere. They did, but I'm just saying that they. They didn't race mix. Let me just put it straight out the way I usually talk here, and the way we talk in this so-called movement. They weren't mixing their race. They weren't even mixing their ethnicity. They weren't even mixing hardly into Germans from other parts of Germany. They were staying the very type that is from this part of Germany, and they remained that. So as I just said, people would think, well, this is good. Other people would think, what's good about it? There's nothing good about it. What difference is it? Isn't it better to get some new views in there, some new blood in there to have, you know, expand your horizons a little bit? Well, I really don't know. All I know, I would say I always believe the latter myself personally, but that's the way I grew up in the United States in the time that I grew up, that was the thinking of a person who read a lot of books like I did and wanted to learn things and go places. I never wanted to stay in my hometown ever. But I know now that it's perfectly nice place to live, and it would have been just fine if I had stayed there. And I might have been better if I had stayed there and raised a family or something. But I was moved along different from what my family had always been. But for that reason, maybe too, I appreciate so much when I look at what they were and how they kept the line going. They kept the births going. They didn't. Not a one of them said, "Well, I don't want to do this anymore," you know, or turned into a dissolute or something. You know, they just. And I have to praise them for that, and see them as doing good, and I'm the beneficiary of that, if you can say that. People think I'm not very good, and therefore maybe I could have been better if they had been different. But I'm going to talk now about an article. I'm going to read from an article I found about Jews in the Christ cult, because we're always talking about, well, what about the Jews in your family? See, I don't believe that there is any Jews in my family background. I'm quite sure there was no Jews around. They left here. They left this area in 1750s, and out there in Santa Ana, Hungary, they had their own community. They were Roman Catholic. I know that even my relatives, my Catholic relatives, when I was a teenager, even believed that the Jews killed Christ. They did, and the Jews were bad people for that reason, and they had no use for Jews. And I know that there weren't, say, people, you might say, oh, there's a bunch of Jews in Hungary. Yeah, but not where they lived, and they wouldn't have had them. They wouldn't have allowed them in there. They might have had to do some dealing with them. Sometimes, I don't know. I don't know that. I don't know. I don't know it at all. But they were not in their community, and they sure would never have married one. And only a few people in this whole family book married a Hungarian. There are some. There are some who married Hungarians. Sure, there's a lot of Hungarians around. But nobody in my direct lines, nobody. There is one in one family line, I don't remember which one now, one sister of, you know, in the family of one of my, you know, back great-great-grandparents or something. A sister married a Hungarian. I think I saw that twice with a Hungarian name. But see, that didn't have anything to do with my blood. You know, it didn't have anything to do with me. But I don't have anything against Hungarians per se at all. So if there was a Hungarian in me, I would say so, because I used to think, well, there probably might be, but it doesn't show up at all, not at all. So here again, I'm just the pure German stock from this Kreisgau area in Germany, from going back till I don't know how far. So let me read about the Jews in the Kreisgau. And this was at a Jewish site, Jewish culture, you know, and when the Jews write, you know, you have to take it into account that Jews are writing this. And they say the most ancient documents mentioning Jews for the current territory of the federal land of Baden-Württemberg date back to the first half of the 13th century. With regard to the Kreischko, the first reference to a Jewish inhabitant occurred in 1288 in Bruxelles. Bruxelles is over there on the edge of the borderline to the west. In the 14th century, reports on Jewish inhabitants of the Kreischgau came about more frequently, among other places in Breton, Sinsheim, Weibstadt, Neckarbischofsheim, Wieslach, and Eppingen. At that time, many towns and villages were promoted to the rank of chartered cities, and they appreciated the services of Jews as specialists in trade and monetary dealing. See, there you go. Who is it? It's the mayors and the town leaders and so on. It's always that. It's always these government people who want the help of the Jews. They want the help of the Jews, so they hire them, not the ordinary people. Well, I should say I discovered that a lot of this area of the Kreischgau was Protestant. There was a lot of Protestantism. I just figured this was all Catholic down around here, but in some areas there are more Protestants than Catholics, actually. So I wasn't able to see a lot of demographic information about religion. It just wasn't on these Wikipedia pages. But anyway, going back to the Jews. The period following the 30 Years' War, and here we find that, as usual, war is always helpful to the Jews and benefits the Jews. I jumped ahead. First we have first persecution and expulsion in the Kreischgau. Okay, the first huge persecution wave, which also affected the Jews in the Kreischgau, occurred during the 1348 to 50, that's 2 years. Plague years. On the absurd accusation, this is the way they write, of having poisoned wells and springs, they were accused of being the authors of the plague. Oh, my goodness. The people were accusing the Jews of bringing on the plague by poisoning the well. For the Kreischgau, the first, they're probably trying to find some way to get rid of them. The first persecution campaigns and are evidenced in this context in Breton, Bruxelles, Weibstadt, Wieslach, and Eppingen. Okay, so they didn't like the Jews there. That makes me happy. Good going, folks. Thereafter, it was only towards the end of the 14th century that Jews are mentioned for the Kreischgau again. But as early as in 1390, they were driven out of all communities belonging to the Electoral Palatinate. All right, so they really didn't like the Jews. The elite people let them in, or the government people let them in to help them with money and trade, but the people took advantage of opportunities to get rid of them. So then there was the 30 Years' War. It was prior to the time after the 30 Years' War, it was hardly possible for Jewish communities to establish in the Kreischgau any community which would have been likely to exist over any periods of time worth mentioning. So they couldn't get in. Temporary admission of Jews was always followed by expulsion. Frequently, only solitary Jews were admitted, with their number being too small to develop any intact community structures at all. It was only after the 30 Years' War that this situation changed gradually. The war led to an enormous decrease of the population, so that labor was scarce. To re-enliven economy and trade, there was a general interest in having labor force settled, including Jews. To re-enliven the economy, there was a general interest, in bringing in more labor because it was decimated by the war, including Jews. And this is the reason why the immigration of Jews can be observed in many places of the Kreischgau during this period of time, with their number increasing stepwise. So they were increasing their numbers once again, they're getting in again. And in the 19th century, clear changes in the legal situation of the Jews took place all over Germany, as we know about. That's the emancipation of the Jews, finally turning them into citizens with equal rights. And in 1862, in the Grand Duchy of Baden, and in 1871, on a Germany-wide basis, an Emancipation Act was passed, which removed all existing legal disadvantages. In the meantime, the number of the Baden Jews had increased significantly. But see, now at this time, my family ancestors were gone. Now, I still had members of my family in Baden all along. Of course, the ones who didn't go to Hungary, but I don't know them. I don't know them, and they don't. I don't know how they continued to live there and populate there. I'm quite sure. And if I, that's another thing. If I went there, I could probably find some long lost relatives. I mean, it would be long lost. I mean, going way, way, way back. So, but I'm sure they're there. And so that's another reason why. In 1808, the count was approximately 14,200. This figure corresponds to a population share of 1.5% in the state of Baden. That's not a lot, but it seems like more than you'd want. The Grand Duchy of Baden had anyway been a focus of Jewish settlement. In 1808, 8% of all German Jews were living in the Grand Duchy of Baden. Wow. And within Baden, an above average number of Jews were living in the Kreisgau, in particular in the administrative district of Sinsheim, where almost every town and village had a Jewish community of its own. The largest Jewish communities of the Kreisgau were found in Hoffenheim, where 272 Jewish people lived in 1839, and Niederstein, where the Jewish portion temporarily accounted for one-third of the population. I don't know where Niederstein is exactly, but terrible. So, but then, guess what? To the rescue come the National Socialists. And they write about it thus. The crimes committed by the National Socialists put an end to the Jewish life everywhere in Germany. Well, I should say the success of the National Socialists put an end to the Jewish life everywhere in Germany. As a result of the relatively high number of Jews living in the Kreisgau, the number of atrocities was comparatively high, too. They say, in the Reichsprogrammnacht, which they called it, Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass, riots and acts of violence occurred in every village and town. Now, they're exaggerating. You know they're exaggerating. Numerous synagogues were destroyed. Well, I read in reading about these towns and cities and so on that one or two were damaged, you know. But anyway, I can't say, and I don't care how many of their synagogues were destroyed or damaged. The only houses of worship spared were those which had been sold to non-Jewish owners before. On 20th October 1940, the 6,500 Jews who were still living in Baden, Palatinate, and the Saarland, all three of these places, that's a large area for only 6,500, were deported to the Gurs concentration camp in southern France. About 2,000 of them died in the camp. In 1942, Gurs became the starting point for deportation to the extermination camp, in particular to Auschwitz. Oh. Now, they say, like everywhere else in Germany, the crimes of the National Socialists put an abrupt end to the Jewish life in the Kreisgau. You see what the National Socialists did? For the people of the Kreisgau. Now, I imagine, we know that Bavaria was strong National Socialist. I imagine Württemberg and Baden were also, although there was also a lot of people, there are also that those people who were against Hitler and the National Socialists, and a lot of Jew lovers and so on. So there's, although Colonel, now I can't think of his name. He didn't like Jews. The colonel who headed the assassination attempt in 1944. He was from down there. He was a count of Swabia. So, but anyway, it was both kinds of people here. But hopefully, the National Socialists were in the majority. But it says that in this way, many centuries of development and tradition had irreversibly ended. Well, good, 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 good. What has remained in the Kreisgau are cultural items, witnesses to the formerly blooming Jewish culture in this region, and worth being protected. Yeah. Okay, that's that article. So now, oh, heavens. Let me see. I better go back to my blog talk page. Now, at this point, if somebody has a real big desire to call in, I welcome you to call in. And, you know, I can always carry the show on a little bit longer. So there we go. The phone number is 323-642-1206. Now, let's see. I got some repeat material here. Somehow I have to get past that. I was going to play a song. I got some new music recorded, and I was going to play the, I don't want somebody to keep Skyping me. Oh, stop it. I was going to play this song, and I think I'll do it, because it's a version of Deutschland über alles. And I know I'm intending on this program tonight to sound very pro, absolutely pro Germany, and like, love your land, you know, love your people, love your ancestors, love your land. If they did good and didn't drag your family bloodline into the mire. So I've got the English version words to this, which I think I'll read real quick. Germany, Germany, above all in the world, when for protection and defense, it always takes a brotherly stand together. From the Meuse to the Memel, from the Adige to the Belt, Germany, Germany, above everything in the world. Repeat it. The second verse is German women, German loyalty, German wine, and German song shall retain in the world their old beautiful chime and inspire us to noble deeds during all of our life. German women, German loyalty, German wine, and German song. Repeat it. And the last verse, and you know that in today's Germany, if you can call it Germany, in today's Federal Republic of Germany, the only part of the national anthem that they sing is the third verse. That's it. The third verse, which goes as follows, which is unity and justice and freedom for the German father. Let us all strive for this purpose, brotherly, with heart and hand. Unity and justice and freedom are the pledge of happiness. Bloom in the glow of happiness, bloom German fatherland. So the first two you can't sing, particularly the first one, because it says Germany above everything in the world. They can't tolerate that. But this is a version of it. Let me find it here by Heino. Here it is. Heino is a famous German singer. It's very dramatic, you know. I mean, it might be too much for some people to listen to, but I don't know. It's not the kind of music I usually play, but I'm going to play it tonight because it's quite stirring, I think. And so here goes. Well, there we go. And Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles. And that's the way you have to feel about what you believe in. If you love it enough, boy, it takes a lot of love and a lot of passion for what you want to bring about in the world to ever make it happen. It doesn't happen with lukewarm feelings. It doesn't happen by trying to just be reasonable all the time. Not that we shouldn't be reasonable, but it takes a tremendous a lot of spirit and I think passion to put behind any project to make something actually appear in reality. So it's music like that is necessary to stir people up, and I don't think it's too much, but I think it's a beautiful rendition. I like it very much. I want to mention talking about keeping our bloodlines clear and clean, Choice of a Mate by Anthony M. Ludovici. And I read this, and I wrote an article in 2007 based on this paper or book of his that is for National Socialist Magazine that I was writing for at the time. And it's on my website under the right sidebar under, I think it's early articles, yes. And you can find it there. But I got very interested in that, and that's when I was introduced to the idea that about breeding true, and breeding in the sense of that what we learn from breeding animals and breeding plants fits for human beings too, and it's not wrong to think that we should do it differently than we do for our animals and our plants. I mean, well, we think we should just haphazardly go around mating with people and finding somebody that you like and just getting married without much thought and into it, and then it doesn't work out. And our expectations are wrong, too. So I learned a lot, and I enjoyed, I still believe what I wrote in that article. This brings me to a story that my friend Wilhelm Christman, not a story, but an incident that he told me about with his daughter. He's, of course, was a good, solid Austrian-German, and his had four children, and his oldest daughter, when she came to him and said she wanted to marry a Greek man that she had, you know, I don't know how long she'd been seeing him, but she was determined. He tried to talk her out of it because he didn't think it was a good match between a German and a Greek. And he said, he's too different, and it won't work out. And he really tried hard to change her mind, but she was determined, and he wasn't going to, you know, he couldn't stop her. And they married, and nothing wrong with this man, nothing wrong with him. And they had two sons. One of them had a little, just some kind of, it's not quite altogether 100%, but not too bad. He functions pretty well. But it didn't work. It did work out. Eventually, there was a lot of unhappy time, too, and eventually they divorced. And then she found somebody else. So these kind of things don't always, just because we're all white or just because we're all, European doesn't mean that that we are not very different and that we should even to this degree stick to our own kind. We should not mix ourselves up too much. It doesn't work. And there's it says in Dr. Frerich's part 9 of his book that talking about, it says, we want to concentrate. I'll just start. He says, we want to concentrate on ourselves, not on these other people that we don't want to be with, but on ourselves, and follow the laws of nature that have separated blood from blood. Everyone is familiar with the faces of mixed-race persons from the harbor districts of the big cities who look so ugly because they are internally unhappy and divided and vacillate this way and that in making a decision. And another part of this is that it says mixed-race persons are unhappy and divided and vacillate this way and that when making a decision. In contrast, the men about whom one knows exactly how they will conduct themselves. In particular situations of life, cowardly or brave, loyal or honorless. Well, it's that idea of breeding true. If you know what the makeup is of the parent, so to speak, then you know what the child will be. It will be the same. And if it's mixed race, if it's two things that don't go together that well, then what you're going to have is someone who's divided between two temperaments, let's say, or two temperaments and two cultural backgrounds and two different blood. Because I do believe, you know, blood is flows through our veins. It's life. It carries life. You die as soon as your blood flow stops. You can't live. And what's in the blood is terribly important. I'm just talking about actual, you know, the healthy form of blood in your body, but it's absolutely vital. And I think that it is like who you are and what you have been going way back. It is in your blood. I do absolutely feel now that what's in my blood is all my feelings and all my thoughts and my family history and so on. Not the history in the sense of history, but you know what I am, so that I am what they were, what's been for many generations. I'm just another shoot off that branch, you might say. You know, I really am, and I used to think I wanted to be more than that. I wanted to be really different. I wanted to be unique and not like anybody else, and so on. And I've seen after enough years of that to realize that that's all just kind of a silly idea, and that it doesn't mean anything. And Adolf Hitler was absolutely right when he said that we need to realize that we're just one link in a chain that is continuing on and on into the future and from the past. And the idea of carrying on that chain is what is so very important, doing our part in that. And this is where we are falling down today in a very bad way. I think I will end with this, and I'm an example of it. But I don't know if we're going to come out of it. I really don't. I'm going to end on a pessimistic note here, because I would say that we're very, very far gone with being willing to have families and children and so on. It's just not happening among white people. It's not certainly not happening among German people. Just sticking with the Germans, there was a story today about Angela Merkel. Or I think it was her. I think it was she herself who said it. She's having this big rally, you know, for the health of Jews. That Germany needs immigrants for labor. That there aren't enough Germans to work. There's supposedly a lot of unemployed Germans, so I don't quite understand how that works. So why these immigrants? Then she says she wants immigrants who can do high level work. Immigrants like with college education. Well, where are they coming from? What are they talking about there? And then they have all these Muslims there, and they're bringing in more Muslims. So this is a serious situation. And it's, as Hitler puts it, it's a lack of the will, and as the French puts it, it's a lack of a will to live. It's a lack of will when you don't carry on life, and that's the most important thing that we can do. And that's why, again, I say, you know, in praise of my ancestors, if they didn't do any great earth-shaking accomplishments, they certainly contributed to life all through these generations, and they certainly added, kept it going, they did their part in keeping it going. I didn't do mine, and I hope that that something will happen to change us, but I see us going in this direction, and I don't see anything that's going to change it, and it doesn't take long for demographics to totally turn around, and so I don't have any solution to offer, except that we need to be talking about this, and we need to be conscious of this maybe more than we're doing. Rather than talk about taking and fighting the Jews, maybe we need to just talk about the responsibility that our people are willing to take, our young men and women, and how to get them out of the clutches of the of this Jewish culture. But it's that's what it is. It does always come back down to the Jews. There's no way of getting around it. On that note, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not going to say any more. I've already gone over my time a little bit, but I'm going to say goodnight to you. I kind of apologize for this show being a little bit pretty disjointed tonight, but I didn't obviously have time to polish it up, so it is what it is. But I think there's an important message here, and I would like to get some feedback on it from anybody who wants to send it. If you put it in the right place, I'll post it, because I think this is very important to discuss and to think about and to put in the forefront. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening tonight. This is Carolyn Yeager with the Heretics Hour on September 15th, 2014.